It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the cost of living is the centerpiece of a new ad campaign to lure millennials to Wisconsin from the Chicago area. But what does the cost of living really mean, and is it enough to make people move? We'll check out a new report from WisContext. First is our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. The president's chief economic advisor resigned yesterday, part of a backlash against proposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced today that the federal government is suing California over its state laws on immigration. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the rift between top Republicans and the president over these tariffs? Do you think they're a good idea, good for business here in Wisconsin, or bad? And do you think the federal government is right to sue California over sanctuary state laws and other policies on immigration? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Callum Borchers is a reporter covering the intersection of politics and media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Let's start with those tariffs. President Trump had announced these last week, 25% on steel imports, 10% on aluminum, and a lot of reaction from Republicans here in Wisconsin, in Congress, and now Gary Cohn, chief economic advisor, out. Can you talk about how the tariff proposal figured into his departure?
Well, it certainly wasn't the only factor, but it seemed to be the last straw. I mean, keep in mind that the president has surrounded himself with people who don't always agree with him or with each other. And you sort of, at least at the outset of the administration, had at least three competing factions, right? I mean, you had some group, including Gary Cohn, of actually Democrats. That included Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. Then, of course, you also had mainstream sort of establishment Republicans personified by his original chief of staff and Reince Priebus, and of course you had the sort of populist nationalist strain of conservatism represented by Stephen Bannon. Of course, all these people, Bannon, Priebus, Cohn, are all gone now, which tells you the kind of churn that you've had in this White House. And so, you know, Cohn has butted heads, of course, with others in the White House. He was personally aggrieved by the president's remarks after the Charlottesville violence last summer. And this really seemed to kind of push him over. You know, he was very much opposed to the idea of imposing tariffs on aluminum and steel imports. He is a free trader, and he decided that he just wouldn't stick around to support the policy if he wasn't, if his voice was going to be overruled in this way.
We'll get into that churn in the White House in a moment. Can you talk about the reaction from Congress and especially Republicans in Congress to these tariffs?
Not great. I think that's sort of the general consensus, and partly because, you know, what the president is doing here, while consistent with the way he ran, it really sort of bucks Republican orthodoxy, right? I mean, the Republican Party has traditionally been the party of free trade and you know, let the market dictate prices here. And I think what's particularly got Republicans' heads in a tizzy about this one is that the steel and aluminum tariffs in particular seem like they could most directly impact some of the United States' strongest allies. They are not the type of targeted action that would hit China very hard, for example. Now, we heard from the White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders just within the last hour that there might be some kind of carve-out specifically for Canada and Mexico, but we'll have to see whether that actually comes to fruition.
I want to bring on a caller on tariffs. Ron is with us in White Lake. Ron, hi.
Hello, hello, and thank you for putting me on. You know, I want to point out that these Republicans, especially Paul Ryan and Scott Walker, must have very short memories, because if it wasn't for their hero, Ronald Reagan, putting tariffs on Japanese motorcycles, the word Harley-Davidson wouldn't even be in our vocabulary anymore, because they would have been out of business in the 80s. So I find it very hypocritical that now they're turning a different tone on these tariffs.
Ron, thanks a lot for calling in. And Callum, one of the concerns that's being brought up by Republicans is a worry that there will be retaliatory tariffs, including possibly on something like Harley-Davidson motorcycles. We've heard Wisconsin cheese bandied about, bourbon from Kentucky, other places with high-profile national Republicans.
That's right. And I think that the caller's comparison is one worth considering, although I would also add that it's worth keeping in mind the difference between sort of a finished product like a motorcycle and a raw material like steel and aluminum. And I think that the concern that some of these Republicans have now is that, you know, we're not talking about a completed good like a motorcycle or perhaps a car coming in, and that if you raise the tariff on an imported raw material like steel and aluminum, that will have a big trickle-down effect, that it will become more expensive to produce some of the finished products that include those materials, everything from, you know, beer cans, right, and soup cans. We heard that example from Wilbur Ross last week. And so I think that's really what the worry is. You know, it might protect the steel mills directly in the United States, but what would the cost be on the manufacturing sector more broadly and on consumers who might ultimately bear the cost?
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at the top stories out of Washington. Let's get back to that churn in the White House idea, Callum. Cohn out now. There have been a lot of departures. As some people rank it, there have been more in the Trump White House in a little over a year than there have been in the last bunch of White Houses in their whole first 2 years. What are you looking at there?
Well, I think it's impossible to deny the fact that this is an unusual streak here of turnover. I mean, you had Sarah Sanders in the briefing again within the last hour saying, look, it's not that unusual to have people come and go in White Houses. And that's true, but not in such a short period of time. And I think it's also worth remembering the circumstances matter here too, right? So I understand the president's position. He talked about this yesterday, that you know, he likes to have people with competing viewpoints in his White House. He thinks that that is a healthy work environment. But we're not always talking about tension here. You might say that that was the contributing factor with Gary Cohn, but it certainly wasn't the contributing factor with someone like Rob Porter, the White House staff secretary, who had to step down last month because he was facing domestic abuse accusations. And of course, the White House really made a mess out of that in the way that it handled public relations. And of course, losing Hope Hicks as the communications director is a blow that's really hard to spin into a positive. I mean, she was one of the president's longest serving aides, with him since the very beginning of his political career, and described by some folks who cover the White House more closely than I do as something of an extra surrogate daughter, you know, someone that he really confided in. So those are not welcome developments, and they're not just the product of a White House where ideas are allowed to compete and emerge for supremacy.
I want to turn now to some news from earlier today. Attorney General Jeff Sessions talked in Sacramento and announced that the federal government is going to sue the state of California for state measures regarding the enforcement of immigration laws. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
California absolutely appears to me is using every power it has, powers it doesn't have, to frustrate federal law enforcement. So you can be sure I'm going to use every power I have to stop that.
So what's the U.S. Justice Department trying to do with this lawsuit, Callum?
Well, they're basically pointing to the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution and saying, listen, you have some limited ability to, you know, set your own policies, obviously at the state level and in localities, but you have to cooperate with the federal government. And I think that the pushback that you hear from California and from cities in California is, you know, what you're asking us to do in a lot of ways is to expend our own resources to assist you, whether it's our officers assisting in raids, or perhaps it's holding people we arrest, you know, in a holding cell simply because they may be in the country illegally, and we're just not willing to do that. I think what was really striking from Jeff Sessions' remarks today, he really, I think, got about as fired up as he does, and he's a pretty even-keeled kind of guy, but he got about as fired up as he does about the mayor of Oakland last week tipping off the immigrant community in her city to a coming ICE raid. And, of course, according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they were able to arrest about 150 undocumented immigrants, but they felt as though the number should have been much larger but for the interference of the mayor. And I think that, you know, as we look at that, I think it's important to kind of distinguish between two kinds of episodes, right? You have cases where you have you know, on the one hand, a mayor who is notifying people in her city of what the federal government is planning to do versus the objection of having local resources spent on what they believe should be federal government work.
And briefly, any reaction from leaders in California on this lawsuit?
Well, they basically said, bring it on. You know, and they've pointed to some previous legal victories that they've been able to score against the Trump administration. And so, you know, whether that is just bluster, we'll have to see. But at least the posture that they're taking publicly right now is that, you know, they believe that any type of defiant act they have taken against the administration, as far as being a sanctuary state and having sanctuary cities, is completely constitutional. They claim that they're on firm legal ground.
Talking to Callum Borchers, reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, checking in on the top national political news of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to get into former Trump campaign advisor Sam Nunberg and his strange series of television interviews this week. Were you following these? What do you think about it? Should he have been on the air? And there's debate over members of Congress sleeping in their offices. Do you think it's inspiring, a gung-ho attitude, or unethical and, as some are saying, kind of gross? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Callum Borchers is with us from the Washington Post, looking at the week's top news in national politics. Callum, I want to turn to this story of Sam Nunberg, a former Trump campaign staffer. He was in the news initially for saying he was going to defy a subpoena from special counsel Robert Mueller. Then he did this series of TV interviews. Here's a little bit of his many interviews. Here he is talking to MSNBC's Ari Melber.
They're not going to send me to jail. You know what, Mr. Mueller, if he wants to send me to jail, he can send me to jail. And then I'll laugh about it. And I'll make a bigger spectacle than I am on your TV show right now.
Well, sir, I don't know.
So a lot of spectacle. Talk about who Sam Nunberg is and what happened over the last couple of days, Callum. It was weird.
It was weird and perhaps a little bit sad. And I think that was sort of what made people uncomfortable watching some of those interviews. But as to who he is, Sam Nunberg may not be a household name because he sort of left a Trump world in an official capacity fairly early in the campaign. He was hired and fired by the Trump campaign several times in 2015 in the early days of the Trump campaign and later ended up locked in a lawsuit when the president accused him of breaching his confidentiality agreement because he had made critical remarks in interviews. So there's some tension there, which sort of made his statements that he wasn't going to comply with the special counsel confusing, right? It was sort of like, well, why, you know, if you've been a Trump critic, you know, why are you going to make life hard on Robert Mueller? But he said he was looking to protect Roger Stone, who is a longtime political operative. He now spends some time working for the conspiracy theory website InfoWars, but he describes Roger Stone as being something like a surrogate father and that he felt like Mueller was perhaps building a perjury case against Stone and he wasn't going to have anything to do with it. But the interviews on live TV at the beginning of the week were sort of bizarre to watch, just in the way that he spoke so flippantly about the prospect of going to jail for contempt of court. And then you had sort of late in the evening on CNN where an anchor who's sitting right across from him says, "I can smell alcohol on your breath." And it sort of just added this bit of evidence to what had been sort of low simmering speculation during the day that perhaps he'd wasn't in full control of his faculties during these interviews. And so then the next day you had a Fox Business reporter who says he's a friend of Sam Nunberg's kind of confirm that idea and say, listen, he's going to check himself into rehab and kind of get the help that he needs.
There were a couple sides as people looked at whether he should have been on all these interviews. The political side saying, yeah, he's a target of the or he's involved in the investigation. There's a subpoena looking for evidence that he may have. And then in these interviews, he's giving hints that, yeah, maybe Mueller has something on the president, on other people. So there's news value. But then people are a little uncomfortable thinking, if this guy is not in his right mind, if he's drunk, if he's not able to consent properly to do these interviews, should we keep putting him on the air?
Yeah, it was really an ethical dilemma. There's nothing clearly in the journalist's handbook for how you handle a situation like this, and I was struck by the very dramatically different answers that you would get. You know, I could call up a journalism ethics expert at Columbia and say, "What do you think?" And he would say, "Well, it's not a reporter's job to protect a grown-up from himself, and he's a public figure, and even if he was drunk on the air, that's a decision he made. And by the way, it's inherently newsworthy that the President of the United States would have chosen to surround himself with someone like that as an advisor in the first place." So take that one point on one hand, and then I can call up, you know, the dean of the graduate school at Berkeley, and he can tell me something totally different and say, I don't think it was ethical. I think that, there is a responsibility for journalists to consider whether this is a person who is, fully able to make decisions for himself. And I had people take sort of a middle ground and say maybe, the right thing to do from a TV perspective would have been to pre-tape, an interview with him and not go live on television. And then, if things seem to go off the rails, you could perhaps not show the spectacle, not sort of give the audience the idea that you're really just trying to put a circus on TV, but that if he did say something of news value, that you could share just that little bit of it. It was a really interesting episode this week that very much divided reporters because, like I said, there's really just no playbook for this.
Talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories this week in national politics. Also this week, the Office of Special Counsel, which is not the Robert Mueller thing. It's a different thing. It's not the Russia investigation. Anyhow, the Office of Special Counsel said that White House advisor Kellyanne Conway had run afoul of some ethics laws. What are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about the Hatch Act, which we've heard with increasing frequency because Kellyanne Conway is not the only administration official this year who has been questioned about whether she is in violation. What the Hatch Act basically states is that, except for the president, he gets an exception, but that other government officials should not be using their official government offices, resources, and perches to advocate for or against people in political races. And that's what Kellyanne Conway did on a couple of occasions when she was on CNN or Fox News, essentially urging voters that Doug Jones, the Democratic Senate candidate in Alabama, would not be the right choice to make, although she didn't explicitly say, don't vote for him and vote for Roy Moore. And that's been the White House's contention. They're really parsing words here on this one and saying, well, she didn't literally say the words, go vote for Roy Moore. She was simply explaining to voters why the president preferred Roy Moore over Doug Jones. It's seemingly a distinction without a difference, and certainly, as you've said, the Office of Special Counsel didn't buy it.
So the Office of the Special Counsel, again, not the Robert Mueller thing, said she had violated ethics laws. Who does anything about that? Is there some kind of consequence to this?
Seemingly not. She may get a slap on the wrist. You remember we saw a similar episode play out again with Kellyanne Conway earlier in the Trump administration when she was, I believe, on Fox and Friends, and she urged viewers to go out and buy Ivanka's stuff. Remember, she was referring to the merchandise line of the president's daughter. That wasn't a Hatch Act violation. It wasn't political speech. But again, she was sort of using her public office to promote a private enterprise in that way. And the White House just basically gave her a slap on the wrist. They said, well, we've had our White House attorneys have talked to her about that. It won't happen again. And that would seem to be, at the most, what we're going to get this time around, although the White House isn't even prepared to concede that she really did violate the Hatch Act. So in any case, it looks like she's going to really get off scot-free here. And so the broader implication is that this is a White House that really just doesn't care very much if its officials run afoul of the Hatch Act.
And then speaking of the use of offices, the Congressional Black Caucus asked the House Ethics Committee to review the practice of lawmakers sleeping in their offices. This is something that a lot of lawmakers apparently do. It was a big thing. Paul Ryan, when he went into office, did this. What's the complaint here?
Well, the complaint basically is that they're essentially taking free rent. You know, they're not renting apartments for themselves on or around Capitol Hill. They're just bunking in their offices as if that's a dormitory. And so that's one complaint. The other complaint from some lawmakers that it's just kind of gross and unsanitary, that, you know, that you're inviting, lobbyists and other constituents to come into your office for these professional meetings in what should be an office setting, and it's basically doubling as the place where you sleep. And there is also some concern about, could there be some abuse of power there if you have aides and you're just sort of rolling out of bed in, whatever state of semi-dress. There's no specific incident that someone can point to. But these are among the concerns that these Democrats have raised and said, look, it's just not appropriate. This is not what the office is for. It's supposed to be in office, and if you are going to spend time in Washington as a lawmaker, then you need to get yourself an apartment.
And what do the Congress people who do sleep in their offices say about why they do it?
Well, they've essentially said that it's the exact opposite. So far from being a taxpayer racket, where we're taking free rent to live in this place, we are better able to serve you, the taxpaying public, because think about how efficient we can be. You mentioned Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. He's talked about this habit in interviews in the past and said, look, I work most nights until 11:30 at night, and then he just wheels out the cot that's in his office. He lies down, and then he just rolls out of bed in the morning, and he goes right back to work. And there's no lost time for the commute or anything like that. So that's sort of the sell, is like, yes, I'm taking free rent, but I'm doing it so that I'm better able to serve you.
Callum, at no point in my career at Wisconsin Public Radio have I had to sleep in my office. Is that how things work at the Washington Post?
No. And, some of these tech firms, right? Remember, we've all heard about the nap pods. And so there was, remember that joke when Jeff Bezos bought the Post, were we suddenly going to have like nap pods or sleeping spaces here at the Post? But that has not come to fruition. There is no sleepovers at the Washington Post. And I think that most journalists, even though they may put in long hours, we do go home at night to our own apartments.
We'll leave it there. Callum, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
That's Callum Borchers. He covers the intersection of media and politics for The Fix at The Washington Post. He was with us for a weekly roundup of national news. A $7 million ad campaign from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is trying to lure young adults from Chicago to live in Wisconsin. One of the main selling points, Wisconsin's lower cost of living. That got our friends at WisContext thinking about how the numbers stack up and what really goes into figuring out the cost of living from one area to another. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext.org. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, cost of living. I will admit, Scott, I see this phrase in a report on the economy or whatever, newspaper reporting, and I think it means something very specific. I assume that the economists of the world have one agreed on definition, and it's universal. It's more complicated, it turns out.
Yeah, it turns out to be fuzzier than I expected when I started looking into this, because you just hear it talked about so much in terms of the decisions that people make and that policymakers and businesses make, about what they're doing, especially when it comes to geography. So, yeah, it turns out it's not a super hard and fast sort of thing.
And we want to compare and contrast sometimes, like this new ad that Wisconsin, the Economic Development Corporation, is airing down in Chicago. One of the selling points for Wisconsin is, hey, it's cheaper to live here. The cost of living is lower. So you looked into some of the different measurements on that. What kind of things did you find out? Is it cheaper to live here than Chicago?
Yes, it's undeniably cheaper to live just about anywhere in Wisconsin than in Chicago, and of course the difference there, depending on how someone's calculating it, can vary quite a bit. And obviously depending on what kind of lifestyle you're expecting to live in one place or another and what kinds of trade-offs that you're willing to make.
Who is out there measuring cost of living? There are a bunch of different official and private sources, right?
Yeah, and the one that seems to be kind of the industry standard, or at least close to it, is something called the Council on Community and Economic Research, which goes by C2ER for short. And they issue a quarterly cost of living index, which is sort of a calculation of the price of a bunch of different sorts of wants and needs weighted differently across, you know, many different metro areas in the United States.
Let's look into what goes into the numbers there and maybe some other sources. It seems like one universal, and this makes sense, everybody's got to live somewhere. So housing costs figure in pretty dramatically on cost of living.
Right. That's the big one. You know, it's the most important factor for just about anyone making a credible calculation about cost of living. And, you know, often that'll be combined with other sorts of essentials like the cost of utilities and healthcare, various measures of the costs of transportation and things like that. And, you know, in the case of C2ER, for example, they'll also factor in sort of different things that, you know, you could either consider necessities or luxuries, it can be about 60 things, and they'll change it a bit over time. You know, obviously the core things like housing will remain the same, but you know, there can be things in there like bowling or tennis balls or a drop-in yoga session, and these are in their formula weighted a lot lower than something like housing, of course. But it's an attempt of sorts to sort of capture the mix of goods and services that, you know, a typical family might be buying in a given place.
Right. Bowling seems very specific, or yoga class, but maybe that's a stand-in for the cost of recreation in an area.
Right. I mean, you've got to assume that people are going to spend some money on leisure activities or, you know, luxuries or indulgences of one kind or another.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about how we measure cost of living and then how we use that to compare, say, Wisconsin versus Chicago. And you put this to the test, Scott, and ran different cities compared with Chicago through some of the different online measurements of cost of living. They didn't all come out with the same numbers. There were some fairly significant differences, right?
Right. And just to clarify, this wasn't a story where we did a whole lot of our own hardcore number crunching, but I wanted to look at some of these kind of consumer-facing personal finance websites that help try to help people understand the differences of cost of living in different cities. So there's CNN Money has one. There's a site called Nerd Wallet. There's this other site called Sperling's Best Places, and they each have calculators or comparisons of a different kind where you can enter two different cities and sort of get, you know, well, a $50,000 salary in this place equals a $56,000 salary in another place. And again, you know, every time through, yes, it's Chicago is going to be more expensive to live than Milwaukee or Madison or somewhere else in Wisconsin for the most part. But there are, we did find some variations and, you know, and some different kind of source material that people were drawing on.
Looking at who the Wisconsin ads are targeting in Chicago, it's not generic person. They seem to be targeting, as I understand it, younger people looking to go into professional careers, right? Does that sway our cost of living measurements at all?
Well, I think it highlights the fact that when you are using a number like that, it can be really useful in a lot of ways, but it can't tell you about the sort of intangible factors that people are kind of mixing in when they're making decisions about where they want to live or whether they want to move for a job. You know, a lot of people have basically said, yeah, I know it's more expensive to live in Chicago, and I'm willing to, you know, shoulder that for certain advantages. You know, a lot of these ads are targeted at people riding the CTA trains in Chicago. So a reporter for the Chicago Reader went and talked to some people riding the CTA. And, of course, some of the ads kind of portray, you know, miserable sort of strap hangers on the train compared with people having a great time, you know, going out to a bar or riding mountain bikes in Wisconsin. And, you know, people made the point that, no, we like being able to ride the train, you know, and obviously for some, I'm sure for some people that's stressful and hectic, but for a lot of people, that's an advantage. You know, they spoke to someone from Wisconsin who was happy to not have to drive anymore, for instance.
Now, one thing you did measure a little bit yourself is what I've decided to call the ramen noodle indicator. Part one of the ads, I understand, shows the Chicagoan strapped for cash eating cheap ramen noodles, the Wisconsinite at a fancy ramen restaurant with all the money they save with our lower cost of living.
Right. I'm fascinated by this video ad. And, of course, it's a trope, right, that people who are broke go buy the little Maruchan ramen packets and boil them up at home. And, of course, there's in just about every city, there's these new ramen restaurants popping up that make, you know, these really gorgeous bowls of ramen. And so I was trying to just figure out, well, I mean, it's an ad. Obviously, they're making a point in a very short amount of time. There's going to be an element of hyperbole and whatnot, and I totally get that. I'm not humorless, but it was kind of funny to me because, you know, if I asked a friend who lives kind of in Logan Square area in Chicago, like, will you just duck into your neighborhood grocery store and tell me what, you know, Maruchan ramen packets are going through for? And, you know, it's something like 50 cents, whereas I think around here it's usually like 20 or 30 cents,
yeah,
depending. And, you know, there's I can't speak to Milwaukee because I don't live there, but, you know, in Madison there's a couple of really great ramen places that you can go out to and, you know, drop a hefty dollar, I think, to have a decent meal. So it was just kind of funny to me that was portrayed as a trade-off, because that's something that's going to be kind of a similar spread wherever you go, I think.
Now, you talked to some economic development experts for this story. What was the sense about the effectiveness of marketing Wisconsin as a lower cost of living place? Did they feel like this is something that's going to lure a lot of targeted young professionals to cross the border?
Well, I think the jury's still out, but the broader background of all this is that, you know, it happens as Wisconsin is really struggling to hold on to and attract young workers, especially, of the kind that might, you know, work at a technology company or what have you. I mean, obviously, there's some exceptions to that, but there is that long-term trend of a lot of parts of Wisconsin are aging, losing population, and, you know, really trying to figure out how do we retain people, you know? And so it's not clear yet whether the argument that Weedick is making in these ads is necessarily going to be successful and you know, convince people that this is the right trade-off to make for them. You know, and one economist that I talked to made the point to me that, you know, people are getting less kind of mobile overall, which I found really interesting. You know, does this experience of moving to take a new opportunity is, you know, I'm wondering, is that something that resonates with fewer people now? I'm kind of really interested to figure that out.
We'll leave it there for now, Scott, and plan our next WPR ramen and bowling party.
All right. Thanks so much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. He joined us for a closer look at what goes into calculating the cost of living in different areas and whether it can help Wisconsin draw younger workers into the state. Wisconsin has a long history of sausage making with many small local shops and large plants. And maybe you or someone you know converts their garage or barn or shed or basement or whatever to a temporary sausage producing workshop each year. Our next guest says more Wisconsinites are getting into the act and it's worth it. Jeff Sindelar is a UW Extension meat specialist and an associate professor at the UW-Madison Meat Laboratory. He's led more than 100 meat and food seminars and makes sausage at home. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of people like me might remember their grandparents. You know, my grandparents on the Polish side of my family would grind kielbasa right there in their kitchen. It sounds like this is making more of a comeback lately.
It absolutely is. But it should be noted that it's been going on for quite some time. It's just gaining more and more popularity across the great state of Wisconsin.
And I understand you grew up on a smaller farm. What's your own history with making sausage?
I did. So I grew up on a small farm in Nebraska where harvesting animals and converting that into different various meat cuts and sausages were very common.
And I understand there's a couple different threads going on here. Hunters, you know, a lot of times you'd have the deer, you'd take it to the processor, they'd convert it into venison jerky, sausage, steaks, whatever. More hunters, it sounds like, are doing this on their own now.
Absolutely. There's, you know, definitely a growing interest in this area, and for lots of reasons. We have lots of hunters in the state of Wisconsin, lots of wild game. And when that wild game is harvested, there's tremendous amount of interest to transform that into food, and definitely a sense of pride and excitement taking that journey and saying, I made this with my own two hands. And there's many, many tools, tons and tons of resources on the internet, as well as, you know, at your local hunting and fishing stores, and lots of expertise to be able to help guide people that are interested in doing that successfully do this.
And then there's a growing interest in the last bunch of years in
artisan foods, local foods, knowing the source of the food you're eating. Well, what better way to know the source than to make it yourself? So a lot of people, even non-hunters, are finding a source for meat and then making their own sausage.
That's correct. The term local has definitely been elevated in terms of its importance and value. And there's nothing more local than your two hands creating something in the comfort of your home, in your garage, in your basement, with friends and family, and then experiencing that product with those same people after you've made those products.
Talking to Jeff Sindelar, he's a UW Extension meat specialist. He's also an associate professor at the UW-Madison Meat Laboratory. We're talking about a growing interest in making people's own sausage around Wisconsin. And Jeff, let's get into the how. Take someone from 0 to 60 here, someone who's never done this before. What are some of the basics that they need to have in terms of equipment and space?
Sure. So it can be very, very simple. So you can make sausage in your kitchen if you've got the right tools. And those tools really are, of course, having the meat. And they don't have to be from game animals. You can go to grocery stores or supermarkets and buy various cuts. You need some way of reducing those pieces of meat into smaller ones. We call that particle reduction. And that can be done very simply with a small grinder, which you can spend just a few dollars on, that clamps on to perhaps your kitchen workspace, or you can even buy small attachments. Let's say you have a mixer, such as a KitchenAid mixer, in your home that you can purchase an attachment, or you can get a little more extravagant and spend more money and become more proficient. You know, perhaps you want to produce higher volume goods. So you have to have some of those simple pieces of equipment. You also have to have the ingredients. So we use the same type of ingredients that you might use for cooking a pot roast or some of the other dishes. You need various spices and seasonings, salt and sugar and pepper and garlic and so forth. And then you just need the ability to put that mixture, which can be mixed by hand, in some type of casing or something to give it some shape and form. And then depending on if that product is something that has to be cooked or not, you can either consume it or use some simple cooking techniques to cook that product.
Let's talk food safety a little bit. I haven't made sausage myself, but I cook with meat, raw meat, and I got to admit, I treat it almost like a biohazard. I'm super careful with it. What kind of hygiene tips do you have if we're making sausage at home?
Yeah, great question. So food safety is absolutely important, absolutely critical whenever you're dealing with food, and especially meat. And it's really because of the bacteria that can be present on meat. So there's some very simple things that you can do. Some very simple principles that will really ensure that safety, food safety, is always upheld. So temperature is one of our best friends. In the bacterial world, we like to say that life begins at 40. So keep meat at or below 40 degrees Fahrenheit when possible, as long as possible, realizing that when you're working on, you know, making a sausage or doing some cutting or doing some type of processing or manufacturing, you may be doing it in a room temperature room, and so that meat will have a chance to raise above 40 degrees. But as long as you limit and minimize how long that meat is exposed to those temperatures, you don't give the bacteria enough time to grow and really grow to dangerous levels. So temperature is really important. And then we have to think about hygiene. So making sure that we are working on clean surfaces, that we are washing our hands, that the utensils that we're using are clean, that helps us make sure that we're not contaminating the meat, or the third point, controlling cross-contamination. So control your temperature, control your environment, so make sure that you're working in a clean environment, and then ensure that you are not cross-contaminating other areas, other utensils, other surfaces during your manufacturing.
So this might be actually a good reason to use that shed or garage or outside space in the winter if you don't mind working in the cold a little bit. That's going to actually help with the hygiene side of things.
Absolutely. Generally, in a wide-open work environment, a space that might be segregated from other other activities, especially food preparation activities. Those are usually really ideal places and locations to make some of these products.
Well, let's make some brats, being in Wisconsin. Talk us through the ingredients that go in there.
Brats are a very unique product. They, of course, are mainstream here in the state of Wisconsin. And it's very interesting. More bratwursts are manufactured in the state of Wisconsin than any other state in the United States. And this should be no surprise, right? They're really the bread and butter of the meat industry in the great state of Wisconsin. So bratwursts are very, very simple to make. We take some type of meat. We need to have a little bit of fat included. Fat is important for both flavor and texture. So having some fat in a meat batter, as we call it, or a sausage recipe, helps make sure that you have a really great eating experience. So we want to have a meat mixture that has roughly 15 to 20% fat. So if you kind of use the analogy of when you go out and buy hamburger, ground beef, and we have the different fat variations. You know, you can buy like 93% lean and 90% lean and 85% lean. Whichever those variations that you like, or whichever variant you like of ground beef to purchase and consume in your household, you really want to target that amount of fat for a bratwurst because it'll be exactly the same. And then we have to grind those raw materials into small pieces, the consistency of a sausage, and then you simply need to add some basic ingredients. So we add a little bit of salt, we add a little bit of sugar, we add a few spices, usually black pepper, garlic, and then you can build upon that and then make your bratwurst very unique and special to what you like.
Are a lot of people taking this to a step two and then smoking the sausage that they make, either into a smoked kielbasa, hate to keep going back to that, or other kind of smoked sausage?
Sure, absolutely. So fresh sausages are the easiest, primarily because you don't have that cooking component. If you want to take that bratwurst, that fresh bratwurst, and make a cooked bratwurst, then you want to add one additional ingredient, and that's water. And the meat industry uses water in a lot of sausages, not to make them cheaper, but to make them high quality. Because when we cook meat, when we cook sausage, we lose some of that water. We lose some of that moisture. And the same occurs if you are making these cooked sausages in your homes. So you take that sausage, that recipe, you add a little bit of water, maybe 10 or 15% of the total weight, you stuff it into a casing, and then you cook it carefully so that you create a very different product than what a fresh bratwurst would be.
As we wrap up, if people out there listening are thinking, yeah, I do want to try this at home, are there resources out there in Wisconsin to help people get started?
There are tons of resources. So you can simply go on the internet and search for making sausage at home. You can navigate to my website, which is University of Wisconsin Meat Science Extension. There are tons of books available for sausage people or those interested in making sausages at all different levels. And there's many workshops that are held around the state to teach people these practices.
And what is your next project, or maybe your most recent project at home that you've made?
So I like to get together with friends and make dry sausage. So we like to make Genoa salami and pepperoni and hard salami and calabrese and those types of things. And we get together and have a great time. We usually have a few vibrations just to make sure that we can get through the event. But it's a wonderful social opportunity. It's a wonderful means of having fun and making something and then sharing that end product with all of our family and friends.
Sounds fantastic. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet. It was a pleasure being here.
I've been talking to Jeff Sindelar. He's a UW Extension meat specialist and associate professor at the UW-Madison Meat Laboratory. He joined us to talk about making homemade sausage. If this is something you do, if you're doing it maybe even this weekend, tell us about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Big news in the world of language, the phrase dumpster fire is now in the dictionary. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary released their latest additions to their online version this week. Now, the words dumpster and fire were both already in the dictionary, of course, but the phrase dumpster fire has taken on a meaning all its own after becoming a meme and a commonly used phrase in sports, politics, and beyond. So here's the definition of dumpster fire: an utterly calamitous or mismanaged situation or occurrence. So you could think, if there was a football team that was a disaster this year, you could say, oh, those guys, they're a dumpster fire this year. It means they're bad. More commonly, the phrase and an image of an actual dumpster on fire was used in politics a lot in 2016 to describe particularly bad moments in presidential campaigns or for the election as a whole. Some other new words in the dictionary include embiggen. It's a perfectly cromulent word from the show The Simpsons. And the word mansplaining is now in the dictionary. Well, actually, the thing you need to know about mansplaining is I don't have enough time to get through it. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.